Merci Annette. Il me fait grand plaisir, comme toujours, d'être ici en tant que doyenne de la Faculté des Arts à l'Université McGill. I have the pleasure this afternoon to introduce you to the moderator of the conference's first panel, which poses the question, is ours a petro-economy? And the moderator of that panel is Mr. Brett House. He is a senior fellow at the Center for International Governance Innovation and the Jean Sauvé Foundation, as well as a lecturer with the McGill Department of Economics and a Chazen Visiting Scholar with Columbia Business School. He has also been a global strategist at Woodbine Capital Advisors, a principal advisor on economic, financial, and development issues in the Executive Office of the United Nations Secretary General, and an economist at the International Monetary Fund, among other professional accomplishments. Although I fit those other ones in among those, I don't know. So I'd like to welcome Mr. House to the table and ask the rest of the panelists to join him.
Thank you for the kind introduction, and welcome to this first panel discussion on Is Ours a Petro-Economy? It's a privilege to be kicking off this conference with such an illustrious panel, and I will introduce them briefly. Annette has already been introduced, but joining her is Christopher Reagan, who is associate professor here in the economics department at McGill and a fellow with the C.D. Howe Institute, among other things. Matthew Mendelson, who joins us from Toronto, from the Mowat Center for Policy Innovation at the University of Toronto. And Satya Das, the author of Green Oil, who is also a founder and consultant with Cambridge Strategies, an Edmonton-based consulting firm. Everyone on the panel has some deep engagement with both the economic aspects of oil and the Canadian economy and Canadian policy more broadly. And it's a privilege to have such a diverse set of circumstances and backgrounds coming together to address this question. From the era of the blue-eyed cheeks in the 70s to the national energy policy of the 1980s, and more recently the development of Hibernia and the tar sands, oil and the oil industry has played an increasing part of our national discourse. And our panelists today are going to examine the extent to which oil is shaping the Canadian economy, how it's doing so, and indeed whether this matters for policy and whether a policy response is required. So to kick off, Annette, you're going to set some of the terms of the discussion here for us. What, in your view, are the hallmarks of a petroeconomy? And how do we know, when we're in a petro-economy, how oil is indeed shaping our economic well-being and discourse?
Okay. Actually, I thought, can I stand up so that I can look at the
Please.
Slide? I thought that the best way to answer this is to have a look at some numbers on how oil and gas, or the industry, really participates in its participation. How do we use energy, and what does it mean for Canada? So let's get some numbers so that we can have at least some. I'm a data freak, so at least, or data geek, at least, to see if what does it say and what do the numbers say. So I have some slides. If you could show me, that would be great. Excellent. Thank you very much. Okay, I am currently at the Inter-American Development Bank, and I'm heading an Energy Innovation Center. In about 3 weeks, we are going to have this database. It's interactive. It's going to be, it's open source, open code, and it has energy data time series from 71 to 2011 from the IEA that we've transformed for all of the countries, our member countries, plus a few other ones. I took the information from Canada so that you have a look of how we use, sort of how we produce or import and export. We have the import and export measured, but we can see that how oil is used and how Canada uses energy. As you can see, transport is a big use of a bigger use. Everything is in thousands of barrels a day. All of the measures are the same. So we have natural gas, coal, hydro, and we have our oil products refining. Then if we look at just oil into the chain, you can see where we go into the refining and how much, this is 2011, and how much we are exporting. So we definitely, not necessarily so much as user, as we are becoming increasingly big exporter. In refined products, because you don't consume oil, you consume refined products. So once you transform it into refined products, and we import and export the same amount, so we're basically in the middle there. Our biggest consumption is not industrial use, but it is transport, and we are a big country. Our energy in terms of electricity, and in this one you'll have the option of gigawatts or thousands of barrels of oil, but as you can see, our electricity matrix in Canada is it's pretty clean. The biggest use is hydro, the second is nuclear, and then amazingly enough, coal, natural gas, and there you have. And by industrial use, we see why the industry doesn't use refined products, because it's using hydro, it's using a lot of the electricity. So when we go into the different sectors, and I was fortunate that Andrew Leach, which many of you know, a good friend, had compiled some of this information and organized it. Wanted to show sort of the cumulative growth rates of the energy sector compared to other sectors. And as you can see, since 97 to August 2013, we've had less variation than you've had in some other sectors, especially durable goods, manufacturing, and industrial production in general. In terms of percentage of the importance of energy for the Canadian economy, as you can see, it is still second to third to real estate and leasing, manufacturing, and then you have mining and quarrying and oil and gas extraction. So when we look at long-term, since 97 to November 2012, you also have not exactly a great differential in terms of percentage to the GDP. If we go any further, we're going to see that I was trying to look for revenue from the federal government, and I'm finding that the statistics right now are really hard to extract. But we know that personal income tax makes the biggest chunk of revenue to the federal government, and given that Ontario and Quebec are the most populous provinces, they are the biggest contributors to federal revenue, not a per capita basis, but overall in gross terms. Corporate income taxes is fairly small compared to the rest. So Alberta, in this case, is third in total contributions, although in a per capita basis is different. And The last show, the last measure that I was looking for was exports. And in that sense, it's just trying to look at the importance of this industry, this sector, to Canadian exports. And this is the place where we see, both in the first and the second slide that I showed, how much we use and how much we export, and in this slide, where you have a significance measure that this industry does represent a good chunk of Canadian exports. And with fluctuations, you can see that the trend since 97, it has been an upward trend. So how much time? Are we good in time? We're good? So basically, I thought that as we set the parameters, it's worth considering that Canada is diverse and has many provinces that are dynamic as well as the oil sector. It's not totally, this is not the only game in town. Thank you.
So having set out some of the basic data, we're going to move to some remarks from each of our panelists. Then we'll move into some interactive discussion and into questions and discussion with audience members. So, Chris, as the macroeconomist at the table, what do you make of some of the numbers that Annette has laid out? You know, she noted that oil is only about 7% of our economy, but energy as a total sector accounts for about 20% of our exports. We've seen over the last few years, as she noted, a lot of change in the durable goods and manufacturing industry, perhaps signs of the lack of competitiveness that's been imposed by appreciation of the Canadian dollar. Adding this all up, do you think Canada is a petroeconomy? And if so, does it matter? And what should we be doing in response on the economic front?
Thank you.
small questions.
So those were three questions. So let me first of all talk about the data that Annette showed and just underline a couple of points. So if you look at oil and gas total in terms of in the Canadian economy in any given year, about $98 billion of Canada's GDP is produced from oil and gas. About a third of that is oil sands, but oil and gas together is about $100 billion. Now that sounds like a lot of money, but most people don't realize how big the Canadian economy is, which is about $1.7 trillion, so that's $1,700 billion. So as Annette showed, oil and gas is about 6% of total. So does that make it a petroeconomy? Well, 6% is almost exactly the size of the retail trade contribution to Canadian GDP. It's almost exactly the same size as finance and insurance. It's almost exactly the same size as education, and it's almost exactly the same size as durable manufacturing. But we haven't designed a conference to talk about Canada, the retail trade culture, or Canada, the finance and insurance culture, or Canada, the educational culture, or Canada, the durable manufacturing culture. We haven't, but we could have. All of that tells me that we're probably not a petroeconomy, or maybe we are, depending on your case of reference, your reference point. So relative to Switzerland and New Zealand, yeah, we're a petroeconomy. Relative to Venezuela, Kuwait, we are not a petroeconomy. What we are, as Annette said, is a highly diversified economy. So 6% of GDP coming from oil and gas does not strike me as a huge number. 21% of our exports from oil and gas. It is the biggest commodity export. It didn't used to be 40 years ago, 35 years ago. The biggest commodity export was forestry products. So that has changed. Oil and gas has risen to dominate, or at least to be the single largest exporter. Now, why does all of this matter? I think there's two reasons why oil and gas production matter economically. Somebody else in this conference, at least probably more than one person, will tell you how it affects our politics. But from a raw economic point of view, I think Canada's oil and gas production affects us in two fundamental ways. Number one, there is this thing called the Dutch disease, which you made reference to. I remind my students, or perhaps inform them every year, that the Dutch disease has nothing to do with legalized prostitution. What it has to do with is the behavior of a flexible exchange rate, and the Canadian-US dollar exchange rate for the most part, in a world of volatile commodity prices. And just as happened in the Netherlands in the late 1950s with the discovery of natural gas, it happens in Canada, and it happens on a cyclical basis. As world prices for our energy products rise, and we are large producers and exporters of those things, that tends to appreciate the Canadian dollar. So what you see from 2002 to 2008, for example, the world price of oil quintupled roughly from $20 a barrel to $100 a barrel, and the Canadian dollar appreciated by about 60%. That is absolutely textbook economic relationships. Nothing surprising about that at all. And when the price of oil and other commodities falls, the Canadian dollar tends to depreciate. Why does that matter? Why it matters is that it creates sectoral and what amounts to, in this country, regional tensions, economic tensions. So as we saw the Canadian dollar appreciate significantly from 2002 to 2008, we also saw central Canadian manufacturing, and for that matter, anybody who's producing and exporting that's not directly connected to the resource sector, we see them hurt. And they were hurt, and they were hurt in a significant way. It's not the only thing that's hurting them, but it is a thing that is hurting them. But we saw the opposite following the Asian crisis in 1997-1998, when the world price of commodities fell by about 30%, the Canadian dollar depreciated, BC and other resource parts of the economy were hurting, and central Canadian manufacturing was laughing all the way to the bank. So what we have is we live in a world where we have a lot of resources, we live in a world where we export a lot of resources, and we live in a world, more importantly, where the world price of those resources is volatile. And the natural implication of that is that we have a volatile currency. If you would like to get into a discussion about why we allow that currency to float and rather than have a fixed exchange rate a la Europe, we can have that discussion. But there's a very good reason why we have a flexible exchange rate. But it does nonetheless cause tensions. It causes regional tensions, as I say, that line up with sectors, so it causes sectoral and regional tensions. Matthew will probably talk about Fed-Prov tensions. It certainly creates Fed-Prov tensions. We have an equalization program in this country that is a federal program that is about redistributing income effectively between provincial governments, and that is influenced by what's going on in these prices. The other thing I would say, so that's the first bin of concerns or issues. The second is environmental. There's no doubt that the production of oil and gas, and in particular, the production of oil from the oil sands, have environmental consequences. And both in the production of those products and in the use of those products. And I'm not just talking about things related to carbon. Okay, there's also the development of the oil sands in particular that causes environmental problems that we need to pay attention to. Some of those are local and provincial problems, some of those are federal problems, and some of those, frankly, are global problems when you start talking about carbon. So the retail trade sector may not cause those same problems that the oil and gas sector causes, and that's one of the reasons that we're here. So I won't give you the policy solutions, although I'm happy to do that in the next round, but I hope that's been an answer to your question.
Terrific. Well, I mean, you set up a natural segue to Matthew's comments alluding to the regional aspects of our oil economy and the extent to which production and the wealth generated by it are concentrated in very small portions of the country. Matthew, what kind of political economy issues does that set up for us to deal with?
Well, it sets up a lot, and I'll keep speaking until you interrupt me, because I have kind of my 2-minute speech on this, my 10-minute speech, my 4-day speech on it. So if anyone wants to sit through my 4-day speech, they're more than welcome. I will YouTube it later. First, let me thank Annette and William for inviting me here. I am nostalgic about this conference. This was the first conference I ever spoke at when I started the Mowat Center 5 years ago. I boldly predicted that we would continue to have regional tensions in Canada 5 years from now. So I'm glad to know that that has been proven correct. And McGill is, of course, my alma mater. So thank you very much for having me. I want to read a couple of tweets that I've received over the last little bit to highlight how complicated and politicized and sensitive this issue is. So I landed last night in Montreal and I tweeted, I will be addressing the issue of whether Canada is a petro-economy. Two of the tweets, one was, it obviously is negative. I hope you wouldn't say anything else. So someone claiming that it is in no way a petro-economy. And then another tweet almost 2 minutes later, there is no chance that anyone can conclude that it is not a petro-economy. So the Twitterverse is divided, which it often is. What I will say is that it depends a lot on your terms of reference. I don't disagree with any of these numbers, and many folks who talk about the fact that Canada is not a petro-economy talk about the relatively small percentage of the economy that it occupies. But I think we would all recognize that in terms of the political economy, the role of the oil sector and the energy sector plays inordinately on a whole series of our economic issues. So Chris has talked about a couple around exchange rates and the impact on the manufacturing sector. We could certainly talk about debates around carbon pricing and environmental regulations more generally. I'll talk about equalization in a second. When anyone's ready for a nap, that's when I'll go into my equalization talk, but I will try and make it at least a little bit engaging for people who aren't familiar with this. So I think that the terms of debate that people are using around this discussion are often different, and I think both are valid. The oil sector is a small part of our economy, but I think we would all recognize it has enormous economic impacts beyond whatever percentage of the economy it represents. When people ask me what kind of economy Canada is it a petro economy? I mean, my first reaction is Canada is an urban economy. And I would love that if, you know, we focused as much on the policies and politics of cities and how you make livable cities as we do on the oil sector. I mean, just, and for most people who live in cities, outside of perhaps Calgary, Edmonton, their engagement with the oil sector in general is almost non-existent. I mean, they may fill up their car or whatever, but they don't have any experience with the extractive side of that. So we are very much an urban economy, and to the extent that we are a petro-economy, I would say we are a regional petro-economy. Canada does not have one national economy. I don't know that we ever have. Canada has worked very successfully throughout our history when the banks on St. James Street and later on Bay Street and the natural resource sector, which continues to expand westward and northward and now is very tied to oil and gas, but is others as well, when they get along. And there have been times in our history, the NEP is one, where there was some sense that central Canadian capital and the western resource sector were not getting along or were not did not have interests aligned. There is no doubt that when the banks in Toronto and the financial services industry and the professional services industry have aligned interest with the oil sector, the country tends to get along and regional tensions are a little bit more moderated. However, there are a whole series of other economic things that are going on. Chris has talked about it a little bit, but I think it bears repeating that we have witnessed over the last decade a profound deindustrialization of southwestern Ontario for people who don't live in Windsor or Niagara or Hamilton or London or Kitchener, and there's some Quebec communities as well, or you could go further in Smith Falls and Belleville. I don't think people appreciate the vast pain that has gone on across those communities and the deindustrialization. If we look at the numbers in terms of exports of durable goods, of exports of manufactured goods, production of manufactured goods, share of employment is a weird proxy because you can get productive and you can bring in robots and all kinds of stuff and still have a vibrant manufacturing sector. But the deindustrialization of southwestern Ontario is a really important story, and it gets politicized in ways that are not helpful. It has very little to do with the policies of provincial governments or even federal governments to some extent. I mean, some of the stuff is global that's going on, but the exchange rate is real. And to talk about it in this country, people are criticized for being anti-Alberta or anti-oil sands, and that connects back to the point that I am making in that we don't have one national economy. We have regional economies in this country, and to talk about the impact of oil on manufacturing or vice versa, and those are real, and they're not anyone's fault, they just happen, but to talk about them, often it gets immediately politicized as being picking on a province or a sector, or someone's not competitive, or someone is lazy, and that's not helpful. And in part, that is because we don't have one coherent national economy. We have a whole series of regional economies, each of which react very differently to things like exchange rates. What people would not also appreciate, in addition to the deindustrialization of Ontario, and I mean, there are ways that this can evolve and change, and the Ontario economy is very diverse, and many parts of it are exceptionally successful and vibrant and growing, but the decline of traditional manufacturing is a real story that I think has gone underappreciated in the national media. The other part of this is that our fiscal arrangements are in no way designed to deal with the current situation. Right now, we clearly have a two-track economy where changes in provinces' relative fiscal capacity, changes in provinces' ability to deliver public services over the last 10 years is almost entirely a function of whether they have natural resource wealth or not. It's not about whether the provincial economy put in, provincial government put in good policies. It is almost entirely about whether you are endowed with natural resources. That has been what has been driving interregional economic disparities over the past 10 years. And I didn't bring charts or anything, but it's very easy to see in Alberta, Saskatchewan, Newfoundland, and Labrador, to a lesser extent, British Columbia. The slope of the line is very, very clear, and the correlation is almost perfect. And our fiscal arrangements, equalization being one piece, but a whole bunch of other policies, are not designed for that. As we know, natural resources are provincially and regionally concentrated. They are owned by provinces, and our redistributive formula do not account for that at all. So the irony of this, and I will explain this in technical detail if anyone wants at some point, is that every time Saskatchewan, Alberta collects one more dollar of resource rents, that is the result in our fiscal arrangements is a redistribution away from the Ontario tax base to provinces to the east, Quebec and the three maritime provinces. That is how the formula operates, and that is clearly not sustainable. So I'd like to conclude with all of this let's see, do I have anything else to conclude?
You don't think that's just payback for the NEP?
Well, it could be, but people don't articulate it that way, do they, or recognize that it is. I guess how I would conclude this is Chris and Annette are both right, the oil and gas sector represents a very small percentage of our economy, but it has enormous reverberations on things like exchange rates and the ability of the manufacturing sector to compete and export. We've had a significant decline in exports. And I would say that the history of our country, and there are notable exceptions, the NEP being one, the role of the federal government has been to attenuate and adjust for these macroeconomic global changes that aren't any one government's fault, that are just part of the process of economic change that goes on in the kind of world we live in. And I would say that over the last 7 years, 8 years, our federal government has had no interest in introducing policies to help economies and regions adjust to these changes, but have instead exacerbated and doubled down and suggested that anyone who raises issues or concerns is the problem, rather than accepting that there are these big global forces. I don't say they're anyone's fault, but the role of a federal government in a country like Canada, where there is no national unified economy, where there is a whole series of regional economies, and where one region's economics impact another region's economics, often negatively, it's the role of the federal government to have a sane, sensible conversation about that and introduce adjustment policies that help moderate and attenuate it, rather than to, in my opinion, double down on this and say that everything's just fine.
Great. Well, I think a hallmark of all three speakers so far has been that the oil sector in Canada is a relatively small share of the economy, but that has outsized spillover effects in other aspects of the Canadian reality. When we think of externalities, as we call spillovers in economics, probably we think of the environmental sector first. And Satya, what are the kind of economic policies we should be crafting, and what are the economic impacts in environmental terms that the oil sector implies both for Canada and for our engagement with the world?
Well, thanks very much, Brett. I wouldn't separate it that way, because to me, energy economics and environment are the one issue, even though the Prime Minister doesn't seem to understand that, to the frustration of a great many thoughtful Albertans. Last September, there was an interim report by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which told us that we're hooped. There's nothing we can do to stop climate change. All these fantasies that we can slow it down, we can do this, we can do that, it's done, it's gone. The amount of carbon in the atmosphere already is presenting us a problem that won't last decades or centuries. It'll last several thousand years. The last three decades have been the warmest in the history of the climate. You've seen the extreme weather conditions like winter tornadoes in Chicago. There'll be lots more of that coming. So even though our oil production, energy production, is a relatively small part of the global economy, Alberta puts out about 3 million barrels of the 85 million barrels of oil consumed in the world on a daily basis. And in terms of greenhouse gas emissions, we're rounding error, about 0.15%. That doesn't mean that we can abdicate completely our responsibilities. In fact, as a democratic petroculture, I think we have a special responsibility. When you look at the IPCC report, what can we do? We need to adapt and we need to mitigate. Adaptation is going to take billions of dollars. It's going to take geoengineering on a scale that we haven't thought about. Imagine putting dikes or an artificial coral reef around Bangladesh, for instance, to save 150 million souls from great turmoil. This is the scope of the challenge we're looking at. Imagine the new technologies that might emerge to harvest existing atmospheric carbon dioxide, because unless we find a way of taking carbon out of the atmosphere, things are going to get worse, a lot worse. For about 6 years now, I've been almost evangelically preaching that we should be using Canada's and Alberta's oil wealth to fund, sustain, and build those renewable energy economies, those sustainable energy economies of the future. And this need not be a money-losing proposition. It be profitable for the planet and for our economics. Right now, if you used all the renewables and all the alternatives out there, regardless of cost, you would not even fulfill two-thirds of the daily energy consumption in the world. That's the reality of alternatives right now. It's going to take hundreds of billions of dollars to scale them up to the affordable market share where we can actually start to use them well. In terms of the wealth that can be generated by this, it's not only good for the planet, it will also fund new forms of innovation in which we will be forced to accelerate in the transition from a petroleum-driven economy toward a less carbon-intensive future. In the case of Alberta, one of the particular frustrations is that for the last decade, the Alberta government, which owns the resource, and its policymakers have been looking at energy, environment, and economy as an integrated issue. We've taken extraordinary steps to try to implement stronger regulatory regimes, extraordinary steps to try to come up with environmental mitigation, to fund and promote mandatory best practices, recently adopted biodiversity offsets, which in exchange for oil sands disturbance in the boreal forest will set aside at least 40% of it in its natural habitat, never to be disturbed, and that could go higher. And the great frustration in the face of all of this has been a Toronto Prime Minister who happened to live in Alberta for a while come and completely betray our province and its aspirations, and for Alberta to be blamed for a Prime Minister who
behaves in the completely Luddite sort of way that he does. I mean, it's just immensely frustrating. And you can't see provincial premiers sort of go up and say, hello, we disagree with the federal government, without punitive consequences, you've seen in this behavior. So in terms of Alberta's leadership on the oil sands and what we've done, we have a carbon tax. Everybody know that? Alberta has a carbon tax. It's $15 a ton on heavy emitters, and right now the Alberta government is in discussions on how much to raise it. And I know that some of the larger energy companies have already calculated a $50 a ton carbon tax. So somewhere between 15 and 50. Now what does that translate into? And that was mentioning Andrew Leach, who's a fantastic number cruncher. And Andrew's figured out that a $1 a barrel levy on a barrel of oil or barrel of oil equivalent is equal to a $10 carbon tax. So a $50 carbon tax would be the same as adding $5 to a barrel of oil. I floated about 5 months ago an idea that I was trying to get some momentum for, and I hope some of you folks will agree today, of actually doing a dedicated green fund for adaptation and mitigation coming out of catastrophic climate change. And because Kyoto was such a painful process, it's completely toothless. There are no consequences for violating Kyoto except a rap on the wrist and being told your deadline is extended. Perhaps we can come up with a working model within the Commonwealth or even La Francophonie. And my idea was to extract a $2 a barrel of oil equivalent levy on all energy produced in the Commonwealth, go into the dedicated green fund. And the way this green fund could be run is another example we already have had in Alberta for several years. It's called the Climate Change and Emissions Management Corporation. It takes the Alberta carbon tax, people apply to it for projects, peer-reviewed process, independent third-party adjudication, and off you go. So one way to get Commonwealth buy-in to make sure that countries like the Maldives survive, that countries like Bangladesh don't get flooded under, would be to use the benefits of production and extraction and to apply them directly to mitigation and adaptation. So that's the big idea I wanted to put on the table, and I'll leave it at that.
Okay. Well, as I mentioned at the outset, a diverse set of perspectives on this question is ours of petrol economy. We're going to move into discussion now. I would point out there are microphones on either side of the room. I'm going to pose just a few questions to the panelists to get our discussion going. In the meantime, please start writing your questions. Please ensure that they're brief and to the point and do not feature a long preamble. We are being streamed live, as others have mentioned, so do ensure that you speak directly into the microphone so that you can be heard by our remote listeners and viewers. To summarize briefly then, it sounds like the panel is saying we have a production side of an economy that is not dominated by oil, but a meta-economy that requires us to be completely preoccupied by oil. We have only a small share of output accounted for by oil and gas, and yet it has a disproportionate impact on our exchange rate. By some measures, I put together almost 70% of the volatility in the Canadian dollar is related to the oil price. And has a massive impact on federal-provincial relations, on climate developments in this country, and indeed on the competitiveness of different sectors. So given that, there are ways in which this conversation sounds almost precisely like one we would have been having in the 1960s on Staples theory and whether we are destined to be a hewer of wood and drawer of water, or whether we can diversify our economy substantially enough to be a more varied and stable participant in global markets. With that sort of background in mind, any of you, what is the next step? Do we need to rethink the way we do economic policy? Do we need to rethink, as Matthew alluded to, federal-provincial relations and our transfer and equalization systems? Do we need to rethink what Canada should be competitive in and how we can stimulate that with policy? Where does policy go next in an economy that is not dominated by petrol on the production side, but whose every move is dominated by preoccupations about oil in some way or another? Annette?
Okay. absolutely true in the provincial federal relationships, and we need creativity to be able to handle this and handle this in a way that doesn't exacerbate the East-West, absolutely. How you exactly do that, a lot more complicated. And the attempt originally made by Alberta to even begin a conversation about Canadian energy strategy was an attempt not to have defined cookie-cutter solutions, but to start talking about this, and because it is a reality, and it is a reality in the country. One of the points that Satya made was sort of, even Alberta, when you're trying to talk how do you diversify the economy, one of the preoccupations Alberta has is how do you diversify the economy, how do you do about it. And one of the ideas, and it isn't, it's in addition to having a carbon tax or to having green funds and so on, is to also focus on what it's taking and how the innovation that you are every day working with in this area, both in the area in the technology of extraction and all of that goes about the energy sector, but also in regulatory innovation. I mean, Alberta is in place and trying to put in place a very robust system of life cycle of impact analysis, of a much bigger impact analysis by area that involves a lot of different elements that you need to measure, that you need to create systems. So innovation in regulation and innovation in services, innovation in technology is one of the ways that at least Alberta is attempting to start a process of diversifying.
Right. So, Matthew, and that says this is complicated. What do you think we can do to get into those complications and resolve them?
So, I mean, there are huge global forces at play here and huge national forces, and we have to be modest in what public policy and governments can do. Often we exaggerate what the role of public policy and governments can do is, but government can do more than nothing, and there are lots of things it can do. I'll say first that government should do no harm, should not exacerbate these issues. So from my perspective, just one issue, for example, that doesn't really deal with this, but 2 weeks ago, Finance Minister ended transfer payment protection for provinces. So for 6 years, provinces collected extra payments if their transfer payments were going to go down. The first and only time that Ontario would be eligible, they canceled the program. So that is like a $700 million hit to the Ontario fisc. There are a number of examples like that. So there has been a particularly punitive approach, I would say, from this federal government towards the people of Ontario. Having said that, if we want to think about the big macro economy stuff, I mean, the way you usually deal with this is investments in infrastructure, investments in science and technology and research. So Satya was talking about adaptation funds. I believe that what you need to do is reallocate and have a concerted policy effort of adjustment, which is around science, technology, research, infrastructure spending, labor market spending, and adjustment that tries to compensate for the divergences that are going on in the economy. We've done this regularly across the country when various industries or sectors or regions were hurt or hit. Again, it doesn't solve all of the problems. And the federal government has done a little bit. I mean, I applaud the federal government's investment in the Windsor-Detroit Crossing and their willingness to spend extra money to purchase land on the U.S. side. But that is one example. I think a much more concerted effort to invest in those things that honestly, Ontario and Quebec have expertise and specialization in, that have been adversely affected by the deindustrialization, and that is our service sector, our R&D, our S&T, and a really concerted effort around infrastructure renewal, which both provide short-term economic investment over transition periods, but sets up the foundation for longer-term prosperity if we're doing more resilient more resilient infrastructure, for example, to update aging infrastructure. So there are lots of policy tools, but first the federal government has to say that it's a problem. That's the first step, and then you can start to look at the specific solutions, and the federal government has given no indication that they think it's a problem. Yeah.
So your emphasis there is on investment rather than rethinking tax systems or equalization. Chris, do you think that's the right approach?
I would certainly rethink equalization. I would definitely do that, and I could give you four or five things. I'd include 100% of natural resources in the calculation for equalization. Now we only include 50%. I would explore making more of our transfers means tested, so CHD, CST, but infrastructure. There are a bunch of different things that one can look at there, but again, it didn't look like it was nap time for everybody. I saw someone yawning, so I didn't want to do that. But 100%, our fiscal federalism, the assumptions built into that are 100% inconsistent with the nature of our national economy right now.
And Chris, is diversifying the economy really the next step, or is it doubling down on the resource sector? Is the volatility U.S. dollar...
Is there a third choice? Is there a third choice?
Feel free to add a third choice but if the intellectual logic of a volatile currency means that the manufacturing sector is always exposed to the ups and downs of the oil sector in a disproportionate way, should we fight that, or should we go along with it?
I think you suck it up. And, I mean, we've lived in a world with volatile commodity prices and volatile exchange rates for a long time, and my guess is we always will, and so you learn to deal with it, and I think many, many sectors do learn to deal with it, and I'm not suggesting that it's not painful at some times. I don't think that's the big problem, although, you know, there's always some time when the movement in the Canadian dollar is causing angst, right? Somebody is always complaining about either its overvaluation, a concept that I will force to put in these things, or undervaluation. Somebody is always complaining about the value of the dollar. I think that is where the government should completely pay no attention. Mm-hmm. Where I think the government needs to pay attention, and it's not just a federal issue, and you mentioned it, so I will take that bait, is to think about reforms to the tax system. So, and let me just talk about reforms to the tax system that relate directly to the energy sector. So there's probably common agreement within this room that there is an issue about carbon emissions and other greenhouse gases. There's probably a common agreement in this room that the current federal government doesn't see this as their issue. Is there any disagreement on that, by the way? No. Okay. So what I think the government needs to do is, and I don't actually believe that this government will do it, but I do think that this or some future government has to rethink the design of Canada's tax system. This also tends to be a boring topic and induce nap-inducing. But I think the truth is that if you actually care about carbon, number one, or other environmental damage, and you also believe that most of this, if not all of it, comes from our behavior. I mean, don't just blame the oil companies, don't just blame the oil sands. Blame yourself for buying a car that runs on oil and using a house that's heated with oil and using plastic products that are made from oil and eating food that is grown with fertilizers that is produced from petroleum products. Our entire life, or much of our entire life, is based on ready access to low-priced petroleum products. And the question is, are we really prepared to do what we would need to do to change that? Now, so you could actually redesign the tax system that would change the incentives that all of us face, as consumers and that all of us face as producers. And I'm not suggesting that that would be the only solution going forward, but I don't know an economist in this country who doesn't think that fundamentally changing the incentives that we face isn't probably a necessary part of a broader policy package. And we could do that. So that is certainly a place that we could think seriously about policy reform.
Right. Okay, I'd like to open up the discussion to questions from the floor. I'm sure there are some even more radical proposals that will come from the group here. I recognize, you know, we've, in some people's terms, stayed in the confines of fairly traditional economic discussion, so feel free to open it much further, and I'm sure, Felix, you're likely to take us in that direction. So please start us off from the floor. Introduce yourself to start. Sorry.
My name's Felix von Geyer. I'm a sustainable development journalist, and I used to lecture energy policy at the other Anglophone university down the road. Now, this is a very interesting debate, and I'm going to pick up really with what Satya's been saying, because I wrote back in December for the Stakeholder Forums Outreach magazine at the Climate Change Conference, basically saying $50 carbon tax or carbon price in Canada would be about 2.5% of total GDP. But if you're talking about 1.7 trillion, it wouldn't even be 2% of GDP. And as we know from the federal government, 2% doesn't seem to be a lot. If you think about it, they're always saying Canada only produces 2% of global GDP emissions. But what you could actually do with that money is quite a lot in terms of the funding carbon capture storage, for example, free university education, carbon revenue neutrality to offset that. Plus, the other thing is picking up on Christopher's point of reforming the tax structure. Here in Canada, we seem to have things like flow-through shares if you invest in the mining sector. Well, why don't you get flow-through shares on pretty much every sector as long as they hit things like greenhouse gas emissions reductions targets and other environmental targets, including like stakeholder engagement, if it, for example, complies with GRI, G4, you know, Global Reporting Initiative stuff. This would probably be a very good way. But it strikes me, particularly with the federal government having really controlled the messaging over it and nobody really coming up with a good response, that we are struggling to actually get the ideas debate. Now, I'd like to leave that.
Felix, could you come to a specific question?
Yeah. So how are we actually going to get the ideas debate kind of out there, you know, to actually come up with a different agenda of our thinking, that it's not just jobs economy and we need the oil sands? How do we change this debate?
Okay, we'll start with Satya on carbon tax, and then anyone who wants to pick up on the broader question of how do we shift the terms of the debate, please do so.
Well, the great thing about the support for Alberta's carbon tax is people know that it's going to a specific use. So when they can see what it's applied to, when you get a list of the projects that were applied for and which ones are successful, that builds confidence. So it's much better than general taxation. So in Alberta, for instance, Felix was mentioning carbon capture and storage. Well, we're finding that storage is kind of a not very useful endpoint because there'll be some containment problems and you're giving away capital forever. You're literally sinking capital. So now it's gone to carbon capture and recycling. There's a whole carbon economy from carbon fibers, carbon materials, and a good reason to store carbon for 5, 10, 20, 25 years is to, again, use it as a feedstock. If you combine carbon feedstock with agricultural feedstock, you have an amazing multi-fiber economy that'll enable you to manufacture all sorts of new and different things. Imagine car parts made out of carbon fiber, and then maybe running on a less harmful fuel later on. So there's lots of innovation to be spurred by having a dedicated carbon fund that would collect and deliver more than Alberta's current carbon tax does. That's why a per barrel of oil equivalent levy would be a real accelerator in terms of funds accumulation, but then it depends on having a transparent process with accountability, honesty, and integrity to look after the collection and disbursement of those funds.
Chris?
Quickly, Felix, your suggestion to expand flow-through shares, I disagree with entirely. I think we should shut them down 100%. Carbon tax, I'm in favor of, but what you do with the revenues matters tremendously. Not only politically, because if you don't do anything with the revenues, it just looks like a tax increase. If you do something with the revenues, then it, depending on what you do with the revenues, you could actually be politically more saleable. But you could also be economically less damaging. I think that issue is important. I think the big issue, to your question about how to, you know, restart this debate, is we've got to depoliticize this debate. You've got to get, frankly, better informed people actually talking less from speaking points and more about facts. And you've got to somehow get this debate, or the set of debates, set of issues, discussed not on a political campaign trail, but somewhere where you can shed more light on the issues and have a reasoned debate. I'm sorry to say that apparently that can't take place in a Canadian political campaign. Maybe it can, but I'm getting increasingly skeptical. So if you can come up with an idea, if somebody can come up with an idea to talk about the sort of tax reform that Felix was referring to and make it depoliticized and effective, I think that would be a good thing.
Okay, let's take another question from the floor. Can I encourage everyone again to be brief and pointed with their questions? And please introduce yourself.
Hi, great. My name is Christian Ngaro. I'm a master's candidate at Concordia. Thanks for the debate. It's refreshing to hear something quite more or less balanced anyways. I'm just actually curious about stranded assets, and given carbon pricing and given carbon tax, which all will probably be in some form or another happening in the future, medium to long-term future, given the impacts of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and the rise in extreme weather events and such, I'm just wondering, like, won't all of these assets just become uneconomic at one point? So aren't we shooting ourselves in the foot by investing massive amounts of dollars in pipelines, et cetera? I mean, I'm thinking about the CN Railway in the 20th century. In the end, it was the federal government that bailed out all the corporations. So won't this happen with TransCanada, Energy East, and all these pipeline corporations? And with respect to all the, like, CCS and all this stuff, it's extremely expensive, so how is that going to work in the long run? It, like, we can say, well, we'll end up dealing with it later, but maybe we won't even have the equity to do so because of all the investments we're making today in the wrong section. Thanks.
So, you know, broad question, should we be concerned about energy companies making investments in the wrong areas or the wrong technologies? Annette?
Yeah, I was going to say, when I look at, I've been a lot more focused on a much broader region, working at the Inter-American Development Bank. We have 48 member countries, and we are looking at investments in 26 countries. So we are looking at energy in a regional, at least in a regional, if not global, but it's certainly larger, a region that includes Canada, but not as a lender, I mean, not as a borrower. But when you look at the picture and our ability to invest, at least in all of the Americas, in renewable energy and in renewable energy projects for baseload and we are a long ways to go. Even in Alberta, to try to do the carbon capture, where do you store? You have multiple leases for storing and for uses that are not reconciled. And when you start reconciling the areas where you're selling leases for storing carbon and you have water usage and underwater usage that hasn't been mapped properly, it's a lot more complicated than what it seems. And it's not a ready solution that is ready right now. But where companies are going to be investing in the future, you have continuing a lifestyle U.S. Major producer, even with the increase in production in the U.S., they will be importing for a while to go, even with the slower economy. If I showed you how the trends on the U.S. economy in usage of energy, I could show you this just another 3 weeks, you can see it yourself. But I think that the investments are not investments that are going to be stranded in that case. And I think the investments in pipeline have shown to be a lot safer than what we are experiencing with the increased use of rail, which I think it really should be, environmentalists should be really aware of that there are consequences for blocking all these pipelines, and the consequences are not benign.
Chris, a quick comment on the stranded assets. Stranded assets would occur if firms were making long-term investment decisions today that would last for 40 years under the assumption that there will be no carbon pricing in the future or other environmental pricing. And then some government comes along and suddenly pulls something out of the hat and introduces a price. But that's not the way the world works. This government, or set of governments may not be smart enough to be imposing a carbon price in the near future, but the companies are smart enough to know that something is happening, not today, but will happen at some point in the future. Large companies today in the Canadian oil patch are building in shadow carbon prices. They're building carbon prices into their investment assessments, and they may be currently low. They're $20, $40, $60 a ton. But their assumption, their bet, is that this will happen. They're playing a long game. And so when it does happen, and I'll be optimistic enough to suggest that it will, then there won't be stranded assets. I mean, there may be stranded assets here and there at the margin. But for the most part, no, I don't worry about this at all. Companies are doing exactly what they should be doing.
Great. Next question, please. Please do introduce yourself.
Hi, my name is Jessica. I'm a law student at McGill. I have a question related to something that Mr. Das alluded to, which is regulatory changes in Alberta. I was wondering if you can comment on whether you think the change to the Alberta Energy Regulator and the regulatory changes brought about by that were positive, and whether they're more stringent or less stringent.
That's something I'm going to sound like a politician on, because I don't know. It's still too new, and it can be a bit confusing. What it's supposed to do is it's supposed to bring under one umbrella energy, environment, and economy as one integrated issue, so that you look at all the dimensions of that in making a decision. That's the theory. How it works out in practice really depends on the quality of the applications that are made and the quality of the decisions that are taken. I think the positive part of it is that instead of having separate things for energy and environment, you're actually looking at it as one, and that the project economics have to include reclamation to biodiversity, a higher standard on, in fact, companies having to put money aside before a project begins for reclamation, enforcing the ultimate reclamation in that in Alberta, after landscape has been re-engineered, you have to monitor for biodiversity for 20 years before you get a reclamation certificate. So looking at that time process and seeing if it's appropriate. And in effect, really looking at it as an integrated issue for the first time. So I think that's the positive. How it will work will depend a lot on citizen scrutiny.
Perhaps we can draw on Annette's Alberta expertise
Just really briefly, the assumption that it wasn't being done is in coherently before is not quite the way it was. So the change is a change that eventually or supposedly will make, as Satya said, you have to see how it's going to operate and all the changes that are made. However, you have still the issue of enforcement. And this is an issue that neither what you had before, neither what you have now are necessarily looking at. Or investing more funds from the regulator to make sure that you have enforcement in wells abandonment and a number of issues. And if that's an issue that needs to be strengthened. It's not enough to regulate. It is important to go and enforce it, and enforce it at more than 10%. So I think that there's a long way, lots of improvements that can be made, and I'm not sure that one regulator addresses those type of issues.
Great. Let's move to this side.
I'm Imre Zeman from the University of Alberta. I just want to thank all of you for a really instructive and interesting panel. I learned an enormous amount. And one of the things that I learned that I thought I knew, but I think I know in a different way now, is actually from Satya's comment about the Commonwealth, an organization I would have never thought to have much involvement in setting carbon taxes or anything else actually at all. But what it made me think about was something that came up in every presentation, which is about the nature of existing political divisions and their role in setting policy and their role in economic development. I recognize that all of the panelists, both those on this panel, but I mean throughout this 2 days, are going to receive questions from the floor that you can't possibly answer. That's the nature of this of the beast that we're looking at. But I wonder whether there is an extreme difficulty in the nature of existing political divisions in setting the kind of economic policy that might help with mitigating, say, climate change. Is there an issue around the fact that to do so right now, for any single polity to do it, would be against its own economic benefit, and so it doesn't happen? Do we have the right, I guess what I'm asking is, in your opinion, do we have the right kind of polity to set the kind of policy that we might need on a planetary scale?
Okay, so let's direct this to Matthew. I mean, in the Canadian Confederation, such as it is, can we address this problem?
Well, I think the question was at two levels that I understood. One is global and questions of global governance and whether individual countries can be first movers on these things. And Alberta, Quebec a little bit, BC a little bit, can be small carbon pricing first movers at a very small level without too much disruption to their economy. But I think globally there are certainly risks, but there are also enormous opportunities that how you structure your tax system and what that price on carbon looks like and where it's going to and if it's going to adaptation research and investment. I mean, you could come out the end with a very healthy economy and have enormous advantages from being first mover. So you might be right, but I actually think that there are real possibilities that are positive for being a first mover in this, if you structure the price on carbon, what you do with those revenues properly and how it impacts PIT and CIT and other things. I think in Canada, we do not. I think it returns to the issues that I raised before, which I won't restate, but we have a history and a legacy in this country of highly polarized regional fights over natural resources and oil in particular, and how those interact with central Canadian banks and financial institutions, and it makes it very difficult to have a sane conversation about carbon pricing. I'm optimistic. I think it can happen, and I think the longer Alberta has a carbon price, you can start to build that out and start slow in what you do with the revenues. But I'd say this, Annette mentioned the EPIC price process, and some of you may have been involved with that, but the process started at the University of Calgary School to have a conversation about a national energy strategy, and I went to a couple of the meetings, and it was heavily dominated by folks from Alberta and Saskatchewan and the oil patch. But we were trying to have a good conversation, and there was a universal consensus in that room, except for me, that, maybe we could do a carbon price, but all of the revenues, if the federal government did a price on carbon, would have to go back to the province from which they derived. It just seemed absurd to me. Like, we don't have a CI, a corporate income tax, or a personal income tax, or a GST, HST. The federal government collects revenues and then distributes them and allocates them. Otherwise, the federal government's just a weird middleman, collecting revenues from provinces and then reallocating them back to the same province. So you get into those kinds of issues where, different provinces will calculate their own balance sheet in a narrow way and say, oh, well, this will cost us a little bit more, so we don't want to do it, or you have to give us all the money back. So I do not underestimate the challenges of having a discussion about carbon pricing in this country, but I do think we're kind of at the nadir, and it couldn't be worse. And so it is plausible that, over the next 5 years, we could start to have a saner conversation where anyone who disagrees with someone isn't demonized.
Can I just add to that I spent a couple of years in Ottawa at the Department of Finance and at the Bank of Canada, and our political and government system, and I suspect it's true in most other countries, is not really designed very well to, it's designed quite well to respond to things that are urgent. It's not designed well to respond to things that aren't urgent but are actually very important in the long run. And it's actually hard to make an argument, especially if you're confined to 140 characters or less. But it's hard to make an argument that, that climate change is an urgent problem in the same sense that the financial crisis in the fall of 2008 was urgent. And so there's a missing sense of urgency, kind of like the challenge of the fiscal implications of population aging. It is here, it's going to ramp up, it's going to be a real problem if we don't deal with it. Well, same thing with climate change, but it's not in people's faces right now. And you need an unusual type of politician, an unusual type of leader that actually looks well beyond their own electoral cycle and looks at the long-run problems. Paul Martin actually did this when he was finance minister to reform the Canada Pension Plan. It was a system that was in long-run peril, short-run, no problem at all, and he actually took it on. I'm not sure we've had the similar kind of vision since then.
So we have about 7 minutes left. I want to include as many questions as possible. So please be very brief, and I'll take all three questions, collect them, and then get some wrap-up comments from the panel. Please go ahead.
My name is Amanda. I'm a master's candidate from New York University. You mentioned the environmental cost and the economic cost of, our petro-economy or supposed petro-economy, and I just think that's something that is really important to consider is the social cost, especially given the environmental racism surrounding a lot of the extractive industry. So just something to think about. My specific question is, I don't have a background in economics, and I'm just curious. I was really surprised to find that the oil and gas sector contributes the same amount to the Canadian economy as other sectors. And I was wondering if you could speak on federal subsidies and if those are distributed across industries equally. And if not, perhaps that's more indicative of a petro-economy as well.
Okay. Over here. Quickly, please.
Hi, my name is Marlon. Satya had mentioned that alternative energy is not able to account for as much energy usage as we get as we use for oil. But there are a lot of innovations that have come out, including some in like solar industry with using a glass ball to get 10,000 times the amount of sun incoming. And Sweden has reduced their carbon usage to 25% of their total usage for the country. So I was just wondering, do we have to address these problems from the ground up, or can we take solutions that other people have successfully implemented and build on them?
Okay. And a last question here, quickly, please.
Hi there. My name is Karen Spielak, and I'm just an ESL teacher, so please forgive me if this sounds simplistic. Given the long history of hemp in creating high-quality products like ship sails and the car was originally designed to run off hemp, what is the economic potential in Canada in shifting from petroleum to a hemp-based products and economy?
Okay, great. I think it's always a good discussion when we end on hemp. So, and I would know we're taking a 15-minute break after this for you to explore whatever aspect of the hemp-based economy you wish to do.
Okay.
So I'm going to start from the far end with closing remarks. Please pick up any aspect of those three questions that you'd like to highlight.
Thanks very much, Brett. In terms of the renewables, to get that from about two-thirds of current replacement to 100% of replacement is going to take many tens of billions of dollars in investment, and that's what we need to make. I agree with you. It doesn't have to be ground up. It has to be scalable. But the fact is that there's just not enough alternatives and renewables available in the marketplace right now, even to meet Indian and Chinese energy demand, which is 4 trillion barrels of oil equivalent over the next 20 years, let alone everything else. So in an all-of-the-above strategy, that's why you need a fund to which you can apply, and you fund different things, a lot of different things, to see which ones tend to work better and which ones can work faster. And as to hemp, that's certainly one of the many fibers that's been considered for things other than burning, and it does have great uses.
I'll just pick up of those three on the first question, because I think it allows me to add a couple of things, but that are consistent with my overall theme. The question was about social costs. As I have said, I think, you know, the oil and gas sector represents a very small percentage of our economy, but has enormous ripple effects in the political economy. So to give you two examples, in Alberta, Saskatchewan, and Newfoundland and Labrador over the last decade, the participation in post-secondary education has been declining significantly. And so mostly young men are choosing to work in the oil patch and the resource sector rather than continuing on to post-secondary education. And that's fine for some people, but that's the kind of implicit nefarious impact that you don't notice right away, but it is affecting people's choices that I think does have real economic impacts over the medium and long term when we think about investing in human capital. The other thing, because the expression was used about, I think was in some operational racism, our immigration policy and the reliance on temporary foreign workers is being driven by the resource sector in Alberta and Saskatchewan and to a lesser extent British Columbia. The switch, the de-emphasis of permanent settlement, choosing people on the basis of their human capital with a pathway to status and citizenship has declined dramatically in favor of choosing people to come on temporary in a temporary role, it's temporary foreign workers, or based solely on their particular job skills to fill particular short-term needs. So there's some stuff that's been going on in immigration policy that I support and is positive, but the overall trend has been to shift our immigration policy towards one of filling short-term jobs in the resource sector. And so again, there are these, and that for temporary foreign workers who have less access to rights and status and enforcement and all of that other stuff. So there are these other impacts that are going on that are being on important policy issues like who gets to come to Canada and join us as permanent residents and citizens that are being driven by the politics of the oil patch. And I don't think we always recognize it, but I think it's having some real impacts on our overall political economy.
One of the questioners lamented the fact that or pointed out the fact that she had no training in economics. Let me just say, for anybody who feels the same way, there's still time.
I'll be registering.
No matter where you live or how old you are, it is never too late to start studying economics. And if you would like, I can give you a reference of a book that you may find useful.
It is for the edition.
So I'd like to comment on the federal subsidies. It is true that there are federal subsidies to oil and gas. Typically, they're not direct subsidies. Typically, they are tax exemptions to the tax system. But to the government's credit, it has been chipping away at these, partly before a G20 commitment to do so and partly after a G20 commitment. The interesting question, though, that I was asking myself after your question was, is it equal across sectors? And I don't know if anybody has done a study to find out if our subsidies, all governments combined, are more generous overall to oil and gas than they are to other sectors. But make no mistake, governments in this country are depressingly prepared, in my view, to give corporate subsidies and what I will call corporate welfare. It is absolutely the case that the aerospace sector in this province has received and continues to receive corporate welfare, and apparently the cement industry has now vaulted to the top of the high-tech sector, and so it will be sucking up public funds, which means it's your money. I do find it depressing. It's not surprising that companies argue the nature as set themselves up as special interests and argue for support from the government. What I find particularly surprising and depressing is that governments continue to believe that individual firms or sectors are special. For the most part, there's not much specialness to go around. And the last comment about, I have no comment on the hemp. I'm not a hemp kind of guy. But should we take solutions, policy solutions from elsewhere? And the answer is absolutely. We don't have to reinvent the policy wheel. We can and should look elsewhere to see what has been tried, what has failed, what has worked. But make no mistake that the Canadian fiscal structure may not be unique, but it is unusual. And so if you're introducing policy at the federal level or the provincial level, you have to think about how the policy interacts with policies at the other level. And you have to do that, I think, with a very open mind about how the Canadian political system works and the fiscal system.
All right. Well, so if you're not the hemp guy, am I the hemp girl? But actually, the hemp is really interesting because it's biomass. And biomass happens to be one of the biggest issues that we have globally. It's people burning. The biggest use of energy globally is biomass, and biomass by meaning wood burning in stoves in Latin America, Africa, everywhere, and our inability to measure it. So when you look at the statistics, it measures biomass, and it measures biofuels, and it measures everything together, so we can't even make a difference. It's a long story, but it might not work out, the hemp. And you couldn't plant enough anyways to produce the energy that you would need. But on the issue of innovation, and I'll speak on the issue of innovation because I had an energy innovation center. And we have secondees, people that come from other governments, sponsored by companies or governments to spend 2 years with the Inter-American Development Bank, and right now we have 8. And I have somebody from Scotland on marine energy, and somebody from Japan on energy efficiency, Italy on geothermal, and so on and so forth. Yes, we are looking everywhere to learn from everybody. Everybody's looking to learn from everyone and trying to move it as fast as you can. But when you are talking big systems and you put wind or you put solar, you also have to put with it a smart grid. So it's not, it's intermittent energy. It's not base load. So the issues are, then we have somebody from Korea that works on smart grids. But they are complex, so we are working on all of them. And I think every country is attempting. Ontario has a wonderful smart grid initiative. GE has one of their research centers right here, right in Ontario, I'm sorry. But it is, we are all trying and putting a lot of efforts. And as far as funds, there is the Global Environmental Facility, GAF, that has a considerable amount of funds for environmentally and sustainable energy projects. And we are one of the administrators at our division, the energy division at the IDB, and we have several GAF projects going in many, many different countries. So I think it's a matter of not one or the other, is that solutions we're going to need all of the above, and.
Well, I think we covered an awful lot of ground in a very short time, and I think that's probably typical of economists who not only recognize that everything is connected to everything, but that economists feel empowered to speak on almost everything. So thank you for all of the perspectives you brought to this discussion. I think, sum up, the jury may be out on whether we're a petro economy, but we're certainly an economy that has to think about petro. And I think the hashtag for this discussion is certainly ripple effects. The impact of petroleum is felt almost everywhere within Canada and needs to inform both our policy, our economic thinking, and the environmental and structural ways we respond to the future. So thank you again to everyone for your